Welcome to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon. I am your host, Shane Bacon. No Clubhouse last week. Apologies, but it's been a busy, busy couple of weeks for us at FS1 and Fox. And that's what I'm talking about this week with Mr. Brad Fax. And of course, this week's episode is brought to you by OGO. I told you all about OGO and the fact that they sent me a nice mutant travel bag. It has the Clubhouse logo on it. And being on the road for a couple of weeks, I got some good testing in. And let me just say, it's easily the best travel bag that I've ever used. It's roomy. It's easy to move around. It wraps itself. It hugs your golf clubs to keep them snug. I even got some compliments at airports from people that said it was a good-looking travel bag. That never happens. The OGO Mutant Travel Bag is a must as you prepare to travel with one of the most important things in your life, your sticks. And good news, if you use the Clubhouse, no spaces, at checkout, you'll save 20% on any product. So go to OGO.com, pick up a Mutant Travel Bag or a Renegade Backpack or a golf bag. Use that offer code THECLUBHOUSE, no spaces. You'll save 20%. That is free money for a cool product. And also wanted to just remind everybody, the FedEx Cup playoffs start this week. That's a perfect time to subscribe to PGA Tour Live. They're currently doing a Twitter vote on the PGA Tour Live main account at PGA Tour to decide the second group they plan to follow around the first couple of days on PGA Tour Live. It could be Brooks Koepka, the U.S. Open champion, Daniel Berger, Kevin Kisner. It might be Gary Woodland playing with Wesley Bryan and Tony Finau. There are four groups you can pick. You can cast your vote and subscribe for the rest of the year to PGA Tour Live as we roll through these playoffs. It's www.pgatourlive.com/subscription, and you can subscribe and you can be at work, watch golf. You don't really have to work anymore. That's the bonus, and it's only $40. That's another bonus. PGA Tour Live is the best value for golf fans for sure. I said I was on the road a lot. We had the U.S. Women's Amateur down in San Diego at San Diego Country Club. Sophia Schubert won that one. And then, of course, last week at Riviera, we had, you know, one of the most unbelievable championship matches you'll ever see. We love doing the amateur at Fox. I think everybody can do it. Joe Buck was talking about it on the broadcast, how much fun he has, you know, being a part of this U.S. Amateur Championship. It's one day older than the U.S. Open. You know all the history behind it. And having it at Riviera was really, really fun. But you never know what you're going to get. Last year, Brad Dahlke won the 19th hole to go one up, and then Curtis Luck won eight straight holes to basically put that thing away in that second 18. And, you know, you get a back-and-forth match, and that's fun, but sometimes they're stinkers. Sometimes you get bad golf that goes back and forth. This was not that. Doc Redman, Doug Gim, they were playing unbelievable. It was birdie after birdie after birdie. Doc Redman in the first 18 holes that Brad Faxton and I were doing, one putted the back nine. He made nine straight one putts in the second nine and then did three more to go 12 in a row one putts. And it looked like for a bit that Redman was going to lose. Gim was really locked in, one of the best amateurs in the world, one of the best amateurs in this country for sure. And it looked like he was going to completely take control of that match. Redman was missing the driver a couple of ways, and then he just found a way to do it. Eagle on 17, birdie on 18. And then wins the 37th hole, of course, on the iconic par 4 10th. It was so much fun to be a part of. And, of course, we got the Walker Cup announcement on the back end, something that we're going to be doing at FS1 as well on September 9th and 10th. So enough from me. I had Brad Faxon on. He was with me all week. He helped with the USGA.org stuff we did in the mornings. And, of course, he was a part of the big broadcast on FS1 and Fox. And I just had Brad to come on. I just asked Brad to come on and chat a little bit about the couple of weeks we went through and the championship match and how much fun it was. Plus, he tells the story of his hole-in-one he made playing with me. Of course, you guys know I don't have any hole-in-ones. If you've ever listened or read anything I've done or you've heard me whine about this over and over again, I'm sure you're sick of hearing it. But Brad Faxon made a hole-in-one in a very interesting game we were playing with our boss and a buddy of his. And it's a good story, so stay for that. And also stay towards the end. He tells a great Walker Cup story as we get closer and closer to Los Angeles Country Club and that matchup between the United States and Great Britain and Ireland. He talks about his Walker Cup experience, and it's a great one. You'll really enjoy it if you like golf and you like any historical things that make you laugh and chuckle. So enough from me. Let's get to our guest. Well, we welcome into the clubhouse somebody that I've spent so much time with. I'm happy he's willing to even do this. We've spent basically the last 2 weeks together. Brad Faxon, of course, an integral part of our Fox coverage of all the USGA events. And we're almost done for the year, Brad. It's crazy to think that. And we're going out with a bang. I mean, that U.S. Amateur Championship match, 37 holes, was, I would say, in the 3 years of us doing Fox Golf, it's probably the most compelling golf we've seen and covered thus far.
Well, Shane, first of all, you know, when Fox signed the contract with the USGA with the agreement to do all of their events, you know, we thought the highlight would be the U.S. Open, the U.S. Women's Open. But these amateur events have been so much more fun to do. And I don't care if it was the U.S. Men's Amateur or the U.S. Junior Boys or the Women's Amateur. And you're right, this week at Riviera, you know, to see Joe Buck, who's probably done more important sporting events, you know, getting out of his chair, putting arms up in his air, raising his voice for a national championship. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's you hope for this, and we had, you know, you think back to the amateur last year, and Joe's mentioned it on air. You and I have talked about it plenty of times, both on air and off. The amateur, both amateurs are a lot of fun to do because you're getting in these matches, you're getting into these players, you know, you're rooting for a player to do this or to keep the match going. You know, you and I did that 30-hole match together at the U.S. Women's Amateur a week and a half ago at San Diego Country Club, and we went 2.5 hours long, and you and I both left going, we would have gone longer. I mean, that's how much fun we were having doing that match, and we were hoping that we'd get something like this. We thought we might get it last year until Curtis Luck went crazy in the second 18 against Brad Dahlke, but we got it this year, and it started with you and I doing the USGA.org stuff on Sunday. These guys were going back and forth, and it was with birdies. I mean, that's what you want to see is great golf, and they were doing it at the exact time they needed to do it.
Well, I think all of us as broadcasters want to see some kind of a close match so that you don't have time to fill at the end. And after the bogey, double bogey start for the, you know, the two finalists, you're like, oh boy, what's this going to be like? And, you know, the play got better and better, and it got better and better the longer they went. And, I mean, what a dramatic, you know, a dramatic win for Doc Redman to come back like he did those last two holes and finish eagle birdie, knock off the favorite, going to, you know, the 37th hole, the extra hole, which was that so well-documented hole, the 10th hole at Riviera, where he actually had to get into the match play in a playoff. So it was storybook, really. And, you know, you said it at the beginning, Shane, you get so invested in these players. You get to like them or dislike them. But we had two very likable guys that just made it easy to watch.
Yeah, you talked about on air, you said Doc Redman had this Padraig Harrington like go about him. I mean, he didn't get really up or really down. He was just kind of relaxed and kind of, you know, plopped around the golf course. But, you know, he wasn't one of those young guys that was screaming at shots. He wasn't one of those guys that had a caddy that was doing that either. You know, Doug Gim and his dad were having a lot of fun, and you could hear it in the broadcast. But this was a guy that was just kind of going about his business, and we talked about his world ranking and all that stuff. But, you know, one of the most red-hot amateurs in the world. How impressed were you with his ability to just continue to stay in it, even with that look on his face that didn't really reveal anything? It was like a poker face.
It totally was. And, you know, I don't know if he was a guy that had yet emerged even among his peers. You know, 70th ranked golfer in the world. He'd had a very good summer this summer playing the, you know, the amateur circuit, but pretty unheralded, really. And, you know, he had a predictable shot. He liked to hit his fade. And then, you know, Paul Azinger hates players when they start having a two-way miss. And then uncharacteristically, he started hitting a few pulls. You know, he pulled his tee shot on number 8 and then got that incredibly lucky bounce on 12 and it kicked back into play, and that clearly could have gone out of bounds. And, you know, just when you thought he was getting nervous and was going to throw it all away, he does the miraculous.
What was the booth like? I had to run out because I was going to grab Spider Miller and do the whole Walker Cup announcement with Diana Murphy. What was the booth like with you three when the putt went in on 17?
Well, you know, we were amazed, first of all, that they both drove it long straight into the fairway. You know, that hole was 580 or 590 yards. It's uphill. Yeah, granted, it was downwind. But, you know, you still got to hit a three-wood from 280 yards. And Doug Gim, who was away by 4 yards, hit first and almost hit the flag stick on the second or third hop. And it just trickled over to the back of the green. I mean, it was an intimidating shot by Gim to go first. And then Redman took no time. He set up over this ball, hit his little cut fade, rolled up there, and it stayed up on the green probably because it was fading and landed a little bit softer. And, you know, Gim had a pretty decent line down the hill and hit a nice chip to 4 or 5 feet. We were saying that's all he really had to do, and then he was going to force Doc Redman to, you know, make this putt. And I had the call, Shane, and, you know, watching this putt as it started to turn at the very end, it was picking up some speed. And, you know, I remember saying it had a good line. And then when it went in, I mean, we all jumped up in the air. I went crazy. I think that's the loudest I've ever yelled on, you know, on air. And we were like high-fiving each other. And then you just kind of let the crowd react because it was a big gallery. You know, we're watching the, you know, the player interaction with his caddy and the fans walking to the next tee. It was beautiful.
Yeah, and you're talking about a young guy. I mean, these are you know, 19 and 21 year old players, and they're going through these emotional roller coasters. And I just can't remember. I mean, I guess you'd have to go back to Tiger. You know, and all those comeback wins he had in these amateurs. He came back in all three juniors and all three USAMs to win those six in a row. But I can't think of somebody that was able to muster up this just ability to get the ball in the hole exactly when he needed to. You know, he had a big par save at 16 that a lot of people forget about. I mean, he had to make that basically to keep the match going. And then, you know, the putt you just talked about on 17. And then he gets to 18, and they're playing these holes. I mean, he birdied 18 in the morning, as did Doug Gim. And then he gets there, and he has to make three, and he hits it, you know, 10 feet. It was just unbelievable shot-making at the exact moment when you had to pull it off. And that's something I've talked to you about this, and Paul Azinger. I can't fathom the ability to step up in the moment right when you need it and find this, you know, this inner, you know, will to make putts and pull off shots. And Doc Redman kept doing it.
It was incredible, really. You know, Redmond's ball, his tee shot on 18, is an iconic finishing hole that's one of the most well-known, one of the most difficult finishing holes in all of golf. And the history that goes back there, you know, to Ben Hogan. I remember watching a three-way playoff with Tom Watson, Tom Weisskopf, and Johnny Miller, you know, battling out, lined with fans. And, you know, Doc Redman hits this ball. It's about a foot in the rough, so it could be a flyer. And he has to sort of cut it because there's a little tree hanging over there. And he hits it in there. It has a little spin. It settles under the hole perfectly. And Curtis Strange, who was on the ground, said, oh, this is not too hard a putt, you know, just maybe right edge. And when the camera showed it, it broke about 5 or 6 inches. It looked like a bowler, you know, trying to hit this big hook shot at the very end. It just broke perfectly right in the middle. Doug Gim wasn't watching. He couldn't watch. And it was such great theater. And, you know, I don't think anybody expected this. They both buried the hole earlier in the first round. So I just keep laughing because, you know, you made the reference to Tiger winning his six USGA events in a row, and the amount of luck that you have to have happen, right, and the amount of skill that you have to have, and when you have to turn it on. And, you know, I don't know that we'll ever see anything like that again. I mean, but Doc Redman, he became Tiger Woods for a day.
That's a good way to put it. And, you know, you talk about, you know, finding, you know, peaking at the right time. Match play is such a unique thing because if Doug Gim goes out there and shoots 5 over in the championship match and Doc Redman shoots 7 over, then Doug Gim's holding the Havemeyer. You know, that's what has to happen. Unfortunately for Gim, he played really solid golf all day long and ran into a guy that played just a little bit better. And I just can't help but feel incredibly bad for a guy like Doug Gim. You know, we talked about it on air, the 2014 Pub Links. He's standing on the 36th hole. He's got a one-up lead. He hits that out of bounds. He hits a ball on the hazard on the 37th hole to lose that. And, of course, you get an invite into the Masters if you do that. And then he gets here. Now, he gets all of the stuff that comes with a finalist appearance, but he's two up with two to go, and he looks like he's in complete control, and then that happens. It's not like he made bogeys, Brad. He's making pars and you know, maybe a conceded birdie on 17, and that still wasn't good enough.
No, it's incredible, and he certainly didn't lose the championship at all. You know, he got outplayed. Redman took it away with that eagle birdie, and you know, Redman didn't really, Gim didn't really hit a bad shot until his tee shot on the 37th hole, and he badly hooked that 3-wood, but it never looked like for a minute he was going to lose. And hey, let's not forget the streak that Redman had of 12 one-putt greens in a row. He one-putted the back nine. I mean, we talk about how tour players now are putting from 10, 15 yards off greens. This guy chipped it from everywhere and chipped it in or close
and made everything when he needed to. I mean, he's making these 30 footers for par
and walking them in. He just had that, I call it a flow state, you know, where he's just so in the zone. He had to feel the touch. And you know, one of his quotes afterwards that I thought was you know, just certainly the way to be was, he said, I just never stopped believing in myself, and I knew I wasn't ever going to give up. You know, it might be a simple sounding statement, but he, you know, and you can always say it, he actually proved it, he did it, and it worked. It was fabulous.
Yeah, and I wanted to touch on Riviera just as a host of this championship for a bit, because, you know, you were kind of our go-to, kind of our historian, really, at Fox, and a guy that loves architecture and golf courses, and, you know, you spoke a lot about it in openings throughout the week about how lovely this place is and how special it is, really, in United States golf lore. And I had a few people reach out to me after this ended and said, could you see a U.S. Open going back to Riviera? And I just wanted to ask you your thoughts on that, because we've had them there before. And after this week, with the way this golf course played now, it sure seems like it'd be a lot of fun to see the pros out there battling for a U.S. Open championship as well.
There's no doubt. You know, the PGA Tour has played the L.A. Open there for, it seems like, 100 years.
I think it's 59 years, you know, of the being around they've had it at Riv, yeah.
Exactly. And in February, the weather conditions are very different. It's cooler, it's wetter. And to see the ball running this week, to see the balls bouncing when they hit the green, was very different here than what we're used to. And, you know, I go back in time to, you know, when George Thomas first came to Los Angeles, and then this was the early 1920s, and we call this the golden age of architecture. And George Thomas himself is a great story. You know, we talked about how he came from money. He was from a wealthy Drexel Burnham family. He learned the architecture kind of as a side job. I mean, this guy had gone to school at UPenn. He studied. He was a captain in the Army. He had a rose named after him. He was a botanist, and he learned architecture from William Flynn, who did Shinnecock and the Country Club and many other fantastic courses. A.W. Tillinghast, one of the most fabulous architects in the world, was from Philadelphia. You know, he was around when George Crump built Pine Valley, and Hugh Wilson designed Marion, or built Marion, and Thomas was just kind of eyes open. And then when he moved to L.A., you know, he did these three courses, you know, Bel Air, where we got to play, which was the other qualifying course, and L.A. Country Club is going to host the Walker Cup, where we will be, and I can't wait to do that. But, you know, this was his masterpiece, Riviera. And the tour players, you know, they know when they get to a special place. And a lot of times, you know, when you're deciding on the venue where you're going to go, you do it based on the quality of the golf course. And surprisingly, the PGA Tour doesn't play many, I call them, A-lister golf courses.
Right.
You know, this is one of the top 20 courses in America, one of the most famed courses in America after Hogan and Hogan's Alley. And there's so much variety there. You know, I always said, and, you know, we picked up on this, that the holes tell you what to do out there. And, you know, if the USGA wanted to bring a U.S. Open, I think they could easily do it. They've added a lot of length with the newer tees. They would certainly have to make the rough a little bit more difficult. So when players missed the fairway, they wouldn't be hitting it out of the rough and being able to stop it on the green. But that would be the only thing they would have to do.
Yeah, and you look over the resume and the list of players that have won, you know, the LA Open or the Genesis Open, whatever you want to call it. And, I mean, you know, you're looking at really the best of the best throughout the year. I mean, you know, you've seen Dustin Johnson have success there. You know, Bubba's a two-time Masters champion. You know, you've seen Phil Mickelson do really well there. And then you go back to kind of your era there where it was Fred Couples and Davis Love and those types of players that had a lot of success. I mean, we saw at PGA Championship there in 1995. I just think spending the week there and seeing the reaction, you know, through social media and through golf and the community around golf saying, you know, it really, to me, it just elevates a championship when you play it at a golf course that people love to look at, love to watch, and know a little bit about. And I think Riviera is one of the few that's a quote-unquote regular tour stop that people know. They know 6, and they know 8, and they know 10, and they know 18. And I think that's fairly rare for, like I said, a regular tour stop in the sense of a golf course that maybe not everybody's played, to know these holes and know what they look like and how they play. And I just think it'd be so cool to see a major go back there, you know, in 10 or 15 years, because it played so well for this U.S. amateur. I mean, people loved it.
Everything you said, I agree with 100%. What's, you know, even more spectacular, too, that adds to it is, you know, the great courses seem to have fantastic finishing holes. And when you think about the 15th hole that's going down the hill, it turns to the right. It's got that massive bunker on the corner of the dog leg. It's shooting back into the ocean breeze. It's got one of the most unique greens in the history. And then you play 16, the par three, that was a forced carry into the wind, short iron with a very sloped green, or if you miss it, it was almost a certain bogey. And then you got a gettable par five, back up the hole, that, you know, so you have a chance. You can make a three, you can make a six. Then 18, where we've seen, I mean, so many great shots and so many people that have fallen apart there with, you know, just a slight miss hit. And the crowds that come out to watch there, I mean, it's, Shane, it's as good a course as there is on any PGA Tour event that they've ever played.
Yeah, I think you were the one that said it. You said it was either the first or second best golf course y'all used to play all year, you know, and I mean, that's including Augusta National. So, I mean, that's pretty elite company. But, you know, what I love, there was a Tom Weisskopf quote we wrote out a couple times, and Weisskopf said, there are 18 finishing holes at Riviera. Great finishing holes at Riviera. You know, you went through the back and you were starting on 15, and my mind started to go back and you go 14, 13, 12, 11. Yeah, and you're like, they're all good. I mean, they're all really good holes. So it was fun to be there. I mean, I love what amateur golf does, and I love what the USGA does with this stuff, where they allow these amateur championships to be at these great golf courses. And you think about Pebble and, you know, Wingfoot and Pinehurst and the upcoming lineup. And you think about the Walker Cup, which, like you mentioned, will be there September 9th and 10th, broadcasting it for Fox, and that at LACC, and, you know, the long list of that and where those courses will be and where they've been in the past. It's just a cool time to be a great amateur player, to be fair, because you get a chance to go compete on these golf courses that you already know a lot about. And, I mean, think about that. If you played well here, and you get an invite or you make it into the amateur next year, you're going to go from Riviera to Pebble Beach. I mean, that's a pretty good 1-2 punch for a 19 or 20-year-old to go through.
Well, and you think about how much more excited just we, the broadcasters, were to be able to go to a course like Riviera versus some of the other courses that nobody knew about. It was just the excitement level of the difference between, say, Chambers Bay and Riviera, and seeing the list of golf courses that we're going to see the next few years on almost all the events that we're going to cover. And the players are going to feel 10 times better about that than we are. So, you know, and you remember these great courses, you remember shots from the great players, and we'll be able to tell stories about Pebble Beach forever. And, you know, Shane, you know, when we had the time yesterday in the finals to show the pieces on the construction of Bel Air, the clubhouse at Riviera, Arnold Palmer's, the first Center Riviera since Palmer's passing, Ben Hogan, the Hogan's Alley, how it got its name. And those are, you know, that's watchable stuff for somebody that's not even a golfer.
Well, you have great memories of Riviera. We talked about it during the week, really kind of throughout the week and into the weekend. But, I mean, at the 95 PGA, you shot 63 on Sunday. You shot 28 on the front nine, including, I think you told me you missed a five-footer. Can you just relive that a bit? And did you relive it in your mind as you were walking around the golf course early in the week, remembering, you know, I mean, that's a 63 on a Sunday to put yourself in position to possibly win is something not many people have ever done in golf.
Well, I remember every shot. I remember every feeling I had before every shot. And I can remember, you know, where on the club face every ball went. And what really made the story to me was I was working with Bob Rotella, the well-known sports psychologist out of UVA. And I had played pretty well for 3 days, but hadn't made many putts. You know, the greens were recently renovated before then, and they had all kinds of bumps and spike marks on them. It was a poor putting surface, to say the least, but the course was, you know, pretty benign winds. Guys were, you know, reaching the par five first back then. And I talked and walked with Bob Rotella on Saturday night before that round. And I knew this was an important event for me to get a top 10 to have a chance to make the Ryder Cup team. And he said, look, I just want you to walk off the 18th green tomorrow and be able to look in the mirror and say to yourself that you had fun playing an important round of golf. And for some reason, those words hit home. They don't always hit home, but you know, when a player gets in a zone, you know, you have senses about shots you got to hit. And I hit a good drive off the first tee, and I was in between a four and a five iron with my caddy. My caddy wanted me to hit a four. I said, I feel like hitting a five there. I'm going to draw this one. It's going to go far enough. And I hit a five iron, hit it just past the hole, and made that first putt. Now, a lot of times, you know, you either let your attitude dictate your mind, or let your mind dictate your attitude. And that was you know, a great way to start around. And then conversely, on the third hole, the hole location was on the right side. I was between a six and a seven iron. My caddy wanted me to hit a seven. And I said, no, I'm going to hit a cut six. And it was the ability to take a little bit off the shot, hit it in there 5 feet. And, you know, so I got off to a good start. Everything happened in the right way. And in that case about missing that 5 footer for birdie on eight.
I don't want to bring up the one bad memory of it, for goodness sakes.
No. But, you know, I think when you're in a bad mood or in a funk with your game, you remember those things and you get angry. But I was somehow able to miss that 5 or 6 footer and not let it bug me, you know. And I put in my mind that, hey, look, you've already made a bunch of them. The greens aren't very good right now. Everybody's going to miss some of these. And I was able to kind of laugh off in a sick sort of way. And then the next hole, it just proved right, because I had 25 footer that probably broke 5 feet. It bounced about six times and then went right in the center of the cup to shoot 28. And I remember I had hair standing up on my arms, my nose, my head, you know, how excited I was thinking about what was going on. And when I got to the 11th green, I had an eagle putt, you know, to go 9 under through 11. And I looked on the first green and there was the last group. They were just starting their round, and this eagle putt would have put me in a tie for the lead. So your mind goes crazy. You know, you can't imagine the things that go through your mind, how fast your mind is and the composure you got to have to get it together.
Well, it's a cool story. Another thing you shared with me, considering we've talked a little Walker Cup, is you had a unique experience on the first tee. And I think this was your only Walker Cup you played in. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, okay. 1983.
Now, tell that story, because I think it gives people an understanding. You know Ryder Cup, you know President's Cup, you know Solheim Cup, which you just watched, and, you know, all the fans and the energy there. But I don't think people totally understand how big of a deal these Walker and Curtis Cups are, and I just want you to explain what happened to you on the first hole of your first Walker Cup back in 1983.
It's a great story. It's a great story because when I see Willie Wood, we can always laugh about it. But, you know, we were one of the top, you know, few rated amateurs in the country then, and when it was played at Royal Liverpool at Hoylake, and, you know, a biannual event. So we had never played links golf before, and we were getting into it. You know, we were getting into it because the people over there were so into it. And I think the fact that we're representing our country, we're wearing uniforms together. You know, you don't play much team golf in golf, never mind at the amateur level. And to make this team is a huge feather in your cap. You're representing the country. And when we went there, and Willie Wood and I were told we were going to play together the foursomes, our captain was Jay Siegel, one of the best amateur players of all time. And he said, hey, you're going to be the first group off. And Willie and I decided he was going to hit on all the odd holes. I was going to hit on all the even holes. We had this game plan. And then all of a sudden, Saturday morning, we get announced representing the United States of America, Willie Wood. And Willie gets up, puts the, you know, peg in the ground, tees it up, gets over his ball, waggles, steps away, and he comes back to me, and he whispers, he goes, I can't do it. And I didn't know what he meant. I go, can't do what? He goes, I can't hit it. I go, what do you mean you can't hit it? And he said, I think you need to go. And, you know, it's a very intimidating tee shot if you were all by yourself, you know, out of bounds, line the right side. It was windy, it was cold. And then you add, you know, a couple thousand people standing by, and the fact that you're representing your country, that your teammates are watching, your captain's standing there, and you're like, oh my God, I'm tightening up here. And I ended up hitting. I got more nervous than I think I'd ever been in my life. I said, if I blow this now, they're going to laugh at us. I aimed pretty far left. I wasn't going to hit it out of bounds.
Well, I just would have loved to see the expression on your face when he walked over and said, hey man, you got to go. I can't do it. I can't pull the trigger. This is, you're just going, so you want me to? You're sitting there all calm and you're going, I don't know, at least I don't have to deal with this. And all of a sudden you got to put my glove on.
It was something else. It was a feeling I probably will never have again in the sport. And something we constantly joke about. But, you know, the funny thing about it was he hit a 5 iron on the green from whatever it was, 190 yards, and I made the putt for birdie. So despite ourselves, we happened to make birdie. We won the first five holes. Yeah.
That's great.
Awesome.
Well, so, you know, you and I have spent basically the entire summer together. I mean, I think you and I are the only people that have done all but one or basically all the USGA events, and it's been a lot of fun doing it and going kind of to places like Flint Hills and going to Missouri and doing all that. But we had a chance to play golf down in San Diego last week when we were doing the women's amateur. And on Saturday, you know, they go early because if there's weather, they can go late. So we always get out of there at noon. So it's a great day. The crew's all excited. Everybody's rushing out of there as fast as they can get out. And we went and played golf. And we played a game that you learned from Louis Oosthuizen called Mulligan Recall. And we had a kind of an unusual experience. So first things first, give, you know, kind of the layman's explanation of what Mulligan Recall is, because I think people listening will really like the idea of playing it when you've got four guys that are all into it and similar abilities.
It's the most fun game I've played in a foursome, and Louis and I live at the same place, Old Palm. So we go out to play this game, and he says, "Look, everybody on the first tee, and you know, you're playing a four ball, basically two against two, starts the day with a mulligan. They can use a mulligan whenever they want, and they can use it off the tee for a second shot or for a missed putt. But you can accumulate mulligans if your team loses a hole. So it's kind of an equalizer in the match. You know, if you get one team that gets ahead by three or four, you can accumulate, you know, those three or four mulligans and use them later on. So if you missed a 4-foot putt, you can rake it back and do it again. And it's so fun because there's strategy, because it depends on where your partner is in the event. And the, I guess the one caveat here is you can only use, if you had three or four mulligans in your bank, you can only use one hole as a player. Each player can use one as a hole if they have them. So the other fun part you experienced this was the recall, when every player can have one of their shots during the round recalled by the opponent, and they have to play it again, whether it was a drive that they smashed, a three wood like you hit on that par five that went close from 290 or wherever you hit it from, or a putter. You know, a long putt's always demoralizing to recall that.
That happened to us as well.
exactly. And then that's happened to you. And then, you know, Mark Loomis, our producer, on the first par three on the front nine, whether it was five or six, says, "What happens if somebody made a hole in one? Could you recall that?" And it was a casual remark. And we said, "Yeah, I guess so." And then on the ninth green, there was a little par three, 150 yards, and pin was kind of hitting over a little knoll. And my partner Loomis hit first, and then I hit this nine iron. It was kind of going at it, and it's just a little left of the hole, kicks to the right, and Loomis is standing off to the only side you could see the bottom of the cup, and I couldn't see it, and you guys were standing on the other side of the tee. He goes, "I think that went in," and he goes, he didn't say it with a lot of emotion.
Not as nonchalant as it could be, he said it. He goes, "Yeah, I think that went in for one."
So, you know, I said, "You sure?" He goes, "Yeah, I think it went in." So then you guys started debating, because the other rule is, you know, if you're going to make a guy have a mulligan or make a guy recall, he has to be the next to play. You can't play out of turn in this game. So you guys made me hit it again. And I was like, "These son of a guns." So, you know, I hit this next iron and it went right at it again. And he was looking at it again. He goes, "No, I can still see that one. That's not in." And we get up there, and sure enough, the first ball was in the hole for a hole in one, and the second ball was, a foot and a half away?
We still lost the hole. That's the best part, is you
still
recalled
lost the hole by two.
We recalled the one, and you hit the second one. You hit it, and you said something like, "I hit that about the same as the first one." And I was like, "Lord have mercy. If he has two in the hole on this thing, I'm never playing this game again." And we get up there, and sure enough, you were in there, and it was a hole in one, too. You hit two shots there on a par three, and that's all you had to do because we gave you the putt. But We were getting slaughtered on the first nine, and then we actually made it a little bit more of a match on the second. But I urge people, if you ever get a chance and you got a good group that people are having a lot of fun, it is a lot of fun. You only get one recall the entire round. So, you know, we used ours early on Mark Loomis. Loomis made a, you know, 25, 30 footer on the 10th hole for birdie, and we were getting killed. And so we used it on Loomy. And sadly enough, if we'd had it around for his tee shot on 17, was this like 270-yard par three, he hit driver to like 12 feet. You know, if we'd have saved it, we would have used it for that time, and it would have given us a really good chance to win that hole. But it really is, there's a lot of strategy, it's a lot of fun, and I'm glad you introduced myself to it, because it's something my friends will really like. But it was crazy. I mean, what was that, your 11th hole-in-one?
That was my 11th, yeah.
Yeah, 11th career hole-in-one, and then you nearly dropped it on top of yourself, and I think that would have been – you might have had to quit golf if you'd have done that. If you'd have gone 1-1 with two swings in a row on the same hole, that might have been it. You might have had to hang them up.
Exactly. It's just a fun game. And Louis, the first time I played with him, We were playing the 18th hole, and nobody had recalled a shot of his yet. Well, he hit a beautiful approach shot that looked like it was going to go close to the hole, and it caught a slope and ended up going about 30 feet away. So he played one of his remaining mulligans on the last hole and hit this next 9-iron to about 2 feet, and then we recalled that shot. So he had to hit the third 9-iron. He was mad at us, and he powered this one over the back of the green. Ended up making four and losing my partner's four net three. You know, we won $100, and Louis was so mad.
He's frustrated. Three 9-irons in a row from the same spot. Just make sure you have sand. That's the key to mulligan recall, because if you have to hit three or four balls in the same spot, you want to make sure you fill in those divots. Brad, what do you got going the next couple of weeks before we get to LACC?
Well, Shane, I haven't been home to Florida where I live in 2 months, so I'm getting on a plane shortly to fly back from L.A. to Florida, spend some time there. I'm going to do a little bit of practicing, a little bit of relaxing, spend some time with my 10th grade to be daughter before she starts school. And then I'm going to get out to the Walker Cup. And I have a feeling when we finish that weekend at LA Country Club, we're going to say it's the best event that we've ever seen.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, that golf course, I got a chance to play it a few weeks back, and, you know, Gil Hance went in there and did an unbelievable job. I mean, everything he does right now seems to be pure gold, but the golf course is great. You know, he's one of those guys. What I love about Gil is that he goes in and he doesn't try to change stuff. He just tries to make it look like it did, or to perfect it a little bit to what it used to look like. And I think that's really important to do. You and I have talked about this a lot, where sometimes you feel like guys go in and try to put their stamp on it. And that's something Gil has never really done. And LACC is a golf course that you don't need to do too much to it. It's one of the best in the country. And so I'm glad it looks and it's going to play the way it plays. And, you know, we got 10 on 10, you know, Saturday and Sunday, and it's going to be awesome. I'm really excited. I get to interview Spider Miller, and he's like the most entertaining human on the planet. So I'll get to kind of be in his hip pocket throughout the weekend.
So in Gil Hance's defense, you know, you made the point that he's good as gold or hot as gold right now. And you know, when architects get asked to come and look at a course to do something, there's restoration, there's renovation, right? So restoration is bringing back to what it was. And, you know, you've got to have a little artistic license there. The interpretation of what the architect would have done throughout time as things mature, plants mature, trees grow, technology's changed. And Gil Hance and his partner Jim Wagner, along with Bill Korn, Ben Crenshaw, and Tom Doak, who will be the other architect that's going to do Bel Air, those guys are as good as it gets right now. And, you know, Gil, if he took out all the old photographs that they had at LA Country Club, and, you know, he found that little tiny par three that was the signature 19th hole that you can play there. It's an amazing place. It's probably the most valuable golf course property, or as David says, it might be the most valuable green space beside a Central Park. So I urge everybody that's listening to this, you got to tune in to FS1 for the Walker Cup, because it's, you know, this match against Great Britain and Ireland, I think we've got a very strong team, the Americans. Hope it's not a blowout for Fox's sake, but I have a hard time thinking that anybody can beat this team this year.
God, it is full of great players. It's going to be a lot of fun. I can't wait for it. I got to do a FedEx Cup event before that, but I'm looking forward to LACC. It's been a crazy year. I mean, I feel like the team has gotten closer at Fox. You know, the golf has been great. We've had a chance to showcase some unbelievable up and down matches. You know, I mean, think back to the boys junior. I mean, four up with seven to play and loses, and Matthew Wolf, and then he makes it into the amateur and makes it to match play. You know, it's been a kind of a crazy year, because we've gotten some great golf, you know, really started at Erin Hills, and we've seen some guys, we started at Erin Hills, and we've seen some guys go crazy, you know, like at the Senior Open. And we've seen some really close matches like we just got at the U.S. Amateur. So, I mean, it's been a lot of fun. You and I've got to hang out so much that you're probably going to delete my number for at least 2 weeks before you have to see me again.
Not a chance, man. It's been a blast. And, you know, we've seen some atypical scoring for what we are used to at U.S. Opens. You know, 16 under par in the display. Brooks Koepka put on a man-sized golf course at Erin Hills. You know, I don't know that I'd want to be playing in next year's Shinnecock event, because I think it's going to be the most difficult course these guys will see ever.
Hey, by the way, I want to compliment you. This was like minimal amounts of name dropping. This might be the least name dropping you've had in a while. Are you okay? You feeling okay?
Well, you know, I got a little offended by our producer, Mark Loomis, yesterday, because I had some pretty good names, you know, dropping in the last couple of events, and I, I brought up our makeup woman's name, Frederic, by first name, and he pings me in my ear, there's no more name dropped. And I'm like, wait a minute, let it at least be Kate Hudson or something.
That's right. We're 30 minutes into the broadcast, no more name dropping, Brad. And you go, okay, fine, I won't do it anymore. The best was when you made the hole in one in the Mulligan recall, and I posted a picture, and somebody on Twitter wrote, I'm sure his best friend Jack Nicklaus has already texted him congrats. And we got a pretty good laugh out of that. It was a pretty good one. But, I mean, you know, Brad, we bust your I mean, you know, for lack of anything else, we bust you the most of anybody, and you take it. So we appreciate it. But, I mean, you know, you bring all of these people, and they talk to you and send you messages. Fred Couples texting you. He's not texting me. So, you know, bring more names if you can. I think it's great for the telecast.
I think it's been a shame. It's really been fun working with you. I like our little tandem we got going, and that's just going to get better.
It's just going to get better. Well, that's Brad Faxon. You can obviously follow along, Brad. He'll be playing some champions events throughout the year, and of course, he's an integral and important part of the Fox team. And I appreciate you taking some time before you fly home and get some downtime. We all need a little downtime. We've been two straight weeks in Southern California.
I know. It's not like it's a tough life, Shane, but it is going to be nice to get to do a few of the things we need to do.
Yeah, you get to watch some Red Sox games. Well, I appreciate it, Brad. We'll catch up soon.
I love it, Shane. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
It looks like I'm a wreck. It's in the hole! It's in the hole!
Many thanks to Brad Faxon, one of the better guys in the world, and especially one of the best people you could ever work with. He is the... I couldn't imagine him not being on our team. I love having Brad a part of it, and excited, of course, for the Walker Cup. And I hope you guys enjoyed those stories. And I hope you guys play Mulligan Recall. And if you do, hit me and Brad on Twitter. He's at Brad Faxon. I'm at Shane Bacon. Just let us know how it went, what you used them on, anything crazy happened. We love to hear any Mulligan Recall stories. So make sure you tag both of us if you guys play it over the next few weeks. A reminder, go to ogio.com. and check out the Renegade Backpack. I've talked a lot about it. I've had it for a few months now. It is literally the briefcase that is chained to my wrist. I need it for everything. Anywhere I go on the road, I have that with me. It's got my laptop and my iPad and my headphones and all my notes and my yardage books and my badges and everything I need to get around and in places and to golf courses with my notes. If I lost that thing, I would be the worst golf broadcaster and commentator on the planet. Hopefully you don't think I am already, but if you did think I'm all right, I would be way worse if I didn't have that backpack. It is literally what I carry everything into every golf event. And trust me, if you're a person that travels and you like to have all your stuff in one place and know it's safe, OGIO's Renegade Backpack is the way to do it. Use that offer code THECLUBHOUSE, no spaces. You'll save 20% on any product on OGIO.com. We hopefully will have another Clubhouse podcast a little bit later this week talking Solheim Cup. That is my hope. Of course, that was another big event that went down over the weekend. And so I'm hoping we'll get a Solheim Cup podcast up later this week. I'm home all week. I got nothing else to do. I might as well do some Clubhouse podcasts. You guys want them, and I'll bring them to you. Follow the Clubhouse Twitter account at the Clubhouse Pod. I'm going to post the highlights from the U.S. Amateur there. If you haven't seen them, it's a good place to catch up. They're about 6 minutes long because there were so many great shots. And appreciate you guys sticking around, listening. Hope you guys enjoyed the chat with Brad Faxon. And hopefully we will be back a little bit later this week with another episode talking some Solheim. Have a great week. Hopefully you get out, play some golf, make some birdies.